You're listening to 90.1 FM KPFT Houston.
Listeners should be aware that the following program contains language and audio images which may be found disturbing and may not be suitable for your snotty-nosed little brat who probably cusses like a sailor behind your back anyway. Parental discretion is advised.
Welcome to another edition of Technology Bites. There you go. That's just how simple it is.
Afflicted is affected tonight. Welcome to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Afflicted's computer.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Dwight. And he's...
Groovehouse.
Dun-da-da, just that simple. Except for the part about getting peed on the air through Skype.
Or Skypey, as some say.
Do some say that?
Yes. Yes, I've heard Skypey.
Huh.
Skypey.
Well, that's just Skypey.
That's kind of odd.
What's odd?
Skypey.
Skypey?
Yes, Aurora says Skypey. Aurora Lasada are...
It's because they pronounce hard P's a lot of times. And like people in South America also say hippie hoppy for hip hop, so you know.
They do, really?
Yeah, in Brazil they do. It's pronounced like hippie hoppy. So it's kind of hard to be like an OG hard gangster and then say hippie hoppy, because, yeah.
Are we talking about bunnies or.
Well, yeah. in Europe it's weefy. Yeah.
That's right, she says weefy also.
Weefy, yeah.
What's weefy?
Significant other?
Wi-Fi.
Oh.
It's weefy, yeah. And Google it.
Apple Mac.
Yeah, they have different words for everything, including our words. All right. Well, hey, Pete, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
All right. Well, you can check us out online at geekradio.com. You can do all kinds of stuff there. Boy, we're all in a lackluster mood tonight, I think. Maybe Pete will have a burst of energy for us. But okay, visit us online. You can also hang out irc.cuckoo.com. Channel is Tech Bites. You can either use your own IRC client or you can join in using the link that we have on our webpage. And the phone number is 713-526-5738 if you want to be on the air with us tonight. We are accepting calls after we do the news. So great geek gathering on Friday. We had a really good turnout. The kind people at Aperture provided us with a couple of bottles of wine and some beer, which is very nice. And we were invaded by 2,600.
Yeah, we had a lot of people out. We even had a lot of black DEF CON t-shirts before they showed up.
Yeah, there was a lot of DEF CON shirts rocking the house before the 2,600 people came up in there. It was a 2,600 fashion show. it was a DEF CON fashion show. But yeah, we had a good time. A lot of good people showed up. We had the run of the place again, so that was nice. But that's all I got. So
it was a very good geek gathering, and it was a lovely Malbec that they and a lovely Pinot Grigio that they treated us to. So they were feeling a little bad because they don't have their beer wine license yet, and so they appreciate our continued patronage. So
they
tossed some our way. Yeah.
Speaking of the way things that we're talking about. Wi-Fi and Skype and Apple Mac stuff. Whenever somebody from Spain or comments on, I'll post something on my Facebook. I have a friend in Spain and he always posts, ha ha ha, but he spells it J-A-J-A.
Ja, 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 ja.
Ja, ja, ja. You're not German. What's the deal? All right. So I'm going to go ahead and hand it off to the Technology Bytes InfoShot live from San Antonio via the Skype. Take it away, InfoShot.
Skype you.
Skype you.
Skype you.
It's the Technology Bytes Info Shot. Technology news and commentary by Peter Hughes. Injected directly into your skull.
All right. Well, over the weekend, there was an interesting hack that happened. And it sort of comboed. I mean, it's perfect for news because it involved Apple and Amazon. Through a combination of things, you could get enough information from Amazon that you could go and mess around with somebody's Apple account too, because apparently the amount of information you could get control of a customer's Amazon account as long as you knew the name, email address, and mailing address of the victim. I think it was a phone-in type system approach, and if you just knew those things, then that was enough. And then now Apple has ended. Apple has a moratorium on changing Apple ID password changes over the phone because of the it was done by Wired reporter Matt Honan over the weekend. He did identity hacking. One aspect of it was that the four digits that Amazon gives you of a credit card to show you just you wanted to use the same card. Were sufficient. Those were the same four digits that Apple asked you to verify, part of verifying your identity, so you could open up, so they could call, change your password, then they have control of all your devices. The hacking was of Wired reporter Matt Honan, not by him. Wired says that on Monday they were able to call Apple, reset Apple passwords over the phone, and gain access to iCloud accounts by supplying AppleCare representatives with a name, email address, mailing address, and the last four digits of a credit card number linked to an Apple ID. And that's the same thing they did to get access to the reporter's iCloud account. From there, once they had access to that, hackers wiped his iPhone, iPad, and MacBook. They also used their access to get into his .me email account, which then gave them access to his Google account, which they wiped too, his personal Twitter account, and Gizmodo's Twitter account. Honan previously worked as a reporter at Gizmodo, and under the hacker's control, both Twitter accounts became a platform to spout racist and homophobic invective. Names with matching email addresses and mailing addresses are easy enough to find on the web. Credit card numbers tied to a name can be found on many purchase receipts, and every day millions of Americans give these valuable numbers out over the phone, ordering pizzas, among other things. So now it's going to get tougher on the people who, particularly if you're doing it over the phone, to try and reset your passwords and that. They're going to probably ask for a lot more information. And, of course, who's calling? You know, the people who are using the phone reset are going to be your more less tech-savvy users, might I say. So you'd think that maybe they'd give the ability to – shouldn't that be a red flag on its own? You know, I don't think that a reporter for Gizmodo, if they're wanting to reset their Apple password, I don't think they're going to be calling up Apple to talk to them to do it. But, you know, I guess they don't really have any way to know the difference. But so interesting. Clearly, Apple and Amazon have something to do to fix this so that people don't get access to these accounts, which are fairly critical. You know, if you're talking about with the cloud and e-commerce, that getting control of the account and the kind of cascading access to things that you can get from having one account, that's something to definitely watch out for. You know, that the although it is difficult, if you start thinking about it, it is difficult to set it up so that if they get access to one of your accounts, that it's not doesn't make it a lot easier to get access to other accounts that you have because of the information that is available once you've gotten logged in. So that one's not just a change your password kind of solution. So we'll keep an eye on this one and see what other identity hacking stuff comes out. And if there's anything we can come up with, we'll help you protect yourself better. In much better new technology news, I don't know if you're familiar with Steam. Most people, you know, it's for games. Video game publisher Valve created the Steam distribution platform to offer easy downloads and installation for Windows and Mac games. The Steam app and online store work for Valve's own games like Half-Life and Portal, and games from other publishers like Skyrim, and indie games like Torchlight. Now the company plans to add non-gaming apps starting in September. So you're talking about an app store that's not really tied as tightly to hardware as, say, the Kindle store or the Apple store or Google's market. In a brief online statement, the company says, quote, "The software titles coming to Steam range from creativity to productivity. Many of the launch titles will take advantage of popular Steamworks features, such as easy installation, automatic updating, and the ability to save your work to your personal Steam cloud space so your files may travel with you." Apparently, it's going to open September 5th, the Steam software store. There's no confirmed list of apps or publishers yet for that date. But software should be added continuously after that, similarly to how Steam works for games. Besides ease of installation, the major advantage on Steam is the ability to easily re-download and reinstall apps on different computers without having to juggle or reset serial numbers, and presumably Steam's software store for this other stuff will work the same way. So that's an interesting one. And this one opens up a big thing, especially because it raises the bar. This one's tied to DirecTV. If you subscribe to DirecTV, you can get the free DirecTV Everywhere app. And the deal is it allows you to watch movies and shows wherever you are, whenever you want, on your iPad or other tablet or smartphone. The thing about this is, based on how it's written, I don't know if it lets you watch whatever you like or if you have to watch what's going on. But when you're at home, you can watch live television or turn your iPad into a remote control and program your DVR, and it won't interrupt any program currently showing on any television in your house. In a sense, I guess this is not a good thing for... Now I'm blanking on the name of it. For some of these devices that you had to hook up a box specifically with it, and then it would stream your media out to you. Now, basically, the direct provider, in this case, DirecTV, is going to allows the direct stuff. One example, the NFL Sunday Ticket Max package, their thing where you can watch, I guess, every Sunday NFL game or something, apparently... Then if you're subscribed to that, you can use – they have an app for that one which means that you could be anywhere. So now when you have to go to that meeting on Sunday or whatever, when there's a game on, you can just bring your iPad and still watch our family gatherings. That's nice. So you don't have to really pay attention on that picnic. As long as you have Wi-Fi, you can still watch the game. There's an iPad app, an iPhone app, and an Android app, and then a Kindle Fire app. So in a sense, I don't know if this I wonder if this doesn't open the door up to, obviously you have to subscribe to DirecTV, but if that doesn't start leaning it towards, if you're watching it on these kinds of devices with these apps, it starts turning it into almost sort of the cable-less approach, where you have that subscription, but you could, I assume you could get the subscription and not even necessarily have the thing hooked up. I don't know. Maybe they won't let you do that, but the fact that they're going to stream it right to you, and it's not tied to the devices, it doesn't sound like it's tied to the devices that you put in your home for the satellite TV stuff, is an interesting move. And the fact that it's across their channels and stuff, that may result in some competition where others, instead of, currently you have to go and kind of get an app for a particular, for a particular channel on a lot of these, where you could do, for instance, examples of like HBO and Showtime, if you've subscribed to them, you on cable, you can get apps. But this sounds like it's more opened up to whatever, to the channels that you're subscribed to, just across the spectrum through one app. So that's progress. In other potential progress, it sounds like on the, and now we're into the, there's a series of Apple things, and then kind of a new product thing that's cool. But this one's rumory. The rumor is that the new dock connector for the next generation iPhone might be even smaller than was suspected before. The rumors had been that, right now the connector, just to be totally geeky about it, right now the connector is a 30-pin connector. TechCrunch said the new would be a 19-pin connector, which Reuters also cited that number in the, rumor-following world. But other numbers of pins have been circulating. iLounge claimed just 8 pins for the new connector, and just yesterday 9to5 Mac reported on a reference to 9-pin in a section of iOS 6 code addressing core hardware features. Regardless of the exact number of pins, it appears that the connector itself will be even smaller than originally thought based on loads of casings seen so far. A French site called nowhereelse.fr, or should I, do I have to read the domain name in a French accent? Nowhereelse.fr posted a new photo showing that there's actually a metal ring inside the casing cutout. So it seems it shows a sort of more assembled version of the phone, and the connector is not that much wider than like the headphone slot, and that's the little, eighth inch. It's just slightly wider than that based on this photo. Another possible interesting thing, the rumors are that September 12th is when they'll announce it. That hasn't been confirmed any farther, but we are getting closer. We're almost within a month of the potential announcement. This doesn't say anything about announcements of other stuff or any of that kind of stuff. This is just an interesting milestone in the new iPad. If you've gone to the Apple Store online and looked for the new iPad, that's what they call it, the third gen iPad, they haven't been there. They haven't been in refurbs. It's all new. And for the first time, Apple's refurbished third gen iPads through their store. The discount on it, they just are the price of, so if you buy the refurb versus the brand new fresh in the box, is $50. Basically, they give you a discount of $50 for the refurbs. So that's, you know, how good a bargain that is, you can look at and decide for yourself. Each unit it includes a one-year warranty as well as a new battery and shell. The availability of refurbished units tends to mark a later phase in Apple products' lifespan, since the demand is no longer so intense that fresh units sell as quickly as they can be produced. The other thing Apple tends to do is let a certain number of refurb units stack up before they put them online. And often this stockpile can persist after a next generation device is released. You know, the first generation refurb long after the iPad 2 came out. And Apple, if you go to their site and you're looking for refurbs, they're selling 32 and 64 gig iPad 2s. As refurbs, even though the only ones building, they're building new 16 iPad 2s. Apparently plenty, and they're available on the site. So that adds to that choice if you're looking for an iPad and you're interested in the latest and greatest, or you're interested more in learning. So just an interesting phase in the new iPad. And finally, on Apple stuff, there's going to be a fairly big change in iOS. If you've had an iPhone or iPad or any of those, they have the YouTube. They had a YouTube app, and a lot of the times when you look, you hit a page with a video that was a YouTube video, it would launch. And now, apparently, Apple's license to include YouTube. The YouTube app has ended, and according to an Apple statement, it says customers can use YouTube in the Safari browser, and Google is on the App Store. So in other words, you won't just get it as part of the OS. You have to download it on your own. You have to select the YouTube app. Now, you may not necessarily have to do that, so you don't have to hurry out and wait for it. The things that... according to Wired's Underwire,
Pete, you're really breaking up. We've lost you almost completely.
Wow, yeah, if it's as good as the reception I'm getting from you, then it's horrible.
It's awesome.
So here's the thing, it's Dwight's fault.
It's Dwight's fault.
He's hogging all the bandwidth.
What?
Dwight threw up an access point. That's not very reliable.
And that's what my computer connected to.
Oh, well, don't connect to it.
Well,
wow, now suddenly you're better. And I'm just.
You know, we need to drop you and reconnect to
the. Here's what I want you to do, Pete. I want you to start counting from one and start counting up, and then I'm going to switch networks, and we're going to see if it actually drops out, and if so, for how long.
Well, that's fun.
All right, so when you start counting, I'm going to flip over to a different network.
All right, Pete.
Okay.
This is like Mars lander science.
For 7 minutes, we won't hear from Pete.
Dwight's got the mohawk.
A reverse mohawk. I have the reverse mohawk.
All right, go ahead, Pete.
I'm already suspended from the wires from the platform. And so
we are good to go.
He's like a marionette. Count, Pete. I think he's
gone. Already lost him.
We already lost him.
I really need to count?
Yes.
One, two, three.
I was told there'd be no math on this test.
Hopefully he's still counting.
Yeah.
Kill Pete?
It's claiming that I'm still connected, but it did flip network.
How many licks does it take to get to the center of a...
And are you over... You know you have to log into KPFT 2.4, right? There's a password.
Yes. I already had it.
Okay. So
I'm already back in. All right. And now my IRC connection works, so... Yours isn't allowing IRC connections out.
And Pete's connection.
And my phone is trying to connect to it. It doesn't do very well. So I think there's just an issue with this.
He's got fo-fi.
Fo-fi.
How high Pete's gotten?
It's like
gotta be
that,
in the 30s by now.
Let's see.
I think he's probably 40s. Stopped counting. I don't think he's on board with the whole counting thing.
It's connecting. So it
48.
You You went to 3, and then it blanked out until you got to 48.
I had a success.
We got
a
bingo.
You put a dog on the surface of San Antonio.
Beat your reference, it takes about 35 seconds.
When you switch networks. Right. Well, this is...
Yeah, I considered jumping to a much higher number, claiming I was from an alternate future, a dark dystopia.
This connection sucks.
I don't think this is any better.
Nice.
Yeah.
Can you at least look around and see if there are any brown rocks around you?
I thought they put an Ethernet connection in there for you. Didn't they put an Ethernet connection?
Maybe there is.
There's one on to the right of Groove House.
Is there?
Does he have an adapter for his air for Ethernet?
I do.
Oh, there is. There's one here to the right.
He's running in there to the rescue.
Yeah, it's right there.
Yeah. But there's no Cat 5.
I do.
Do you? You want to try that? Somebody needs to talk.
Look, not only do I have the Ethernet adapter for my Mac Air and a 25-foot black Cat 5e cable, I've also got a USB serial converter and a 9-pin DB9 serial cable.
All right.
Oh. Hold on.
Little geek cred.
I think the slow clap has to be louder, though.
Does it? No. I don't have the loud clap. All right, so are we going to try to hook up to the Ethernet now? So that means another lost connection. Actually, you should be able to connect the Ethernet. I don't know what's going to happen here. We're probably going to lose Pete again for a little bit of time. But.
It seems that Skype, it switches to the weird where it says trying to start connecting, it rings and then like answers, you know, automatically when it tries to reconnect.
The other problem is that, you know, I have the original MacBook Air. It only has one Ether, a USB, so I also have to plug in a USB hub.
The audio in and out to stream out to me, and for my audio to come in goes through the through a USB device on the air on
which makes for great radio.
Afflicted's MacBook Air.
Could we go ahead and take a call?
Lost a call while going through that.
We lost the call. Maybe, you know, he was on our Wi-Fi connection and dropped.
I know that coming up, and we'll announce it when it's closer to it, that there may be a break where we're not on the air on a Wednesday evening, and maybe if schedules permit, maybe we should come in that Wednesday evening and
set
see if we
Skype
can
server.
Do some things to get some stuff set up and try and make it more bulletproof.
That'd be awesome.
I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. Have to see if we could pull that off. That would require planning and forethought.
Well, at least the calendar favors us because it's in the future. And hey, you know, last week we should have done this.
Right. Well, we're actually attempting to look ahead. So
we're halfway there.
Yeah, we have good intentions. We might get to hell. So, all right. Looks like we got calls in the queue, and we got the one call that
we lost. Yeah.
And we got him coming back. So Groovehouse is about to slip on his headphones, and he's going to tell us what's what. And then
Say what again?
Hippie hoppy. You're about
Pete,
to.
We're gonna drop.
Oh, we're gonna drop you again, Pete. You don't have to count though.
One.
Unless you want to.
Two.
You must count in Fibonacci numbers. All right.
So, who do we call?
Who we have?
All right. Up first on the show, we are going to take John.
John, you're on the Aero Technology Bites.
How are you guys tonight?
Good. How are you?
I'm okay. I have a question about... I have a new Samsung plasma TV. It's a smart TV. And when I bought that TV, I got a power strip with it where it's got a master plug where, you know, it'll stay on, something will stay on, and when you shut that off, it shuts off the power strip and shuts the power off to everything else. My question is this: if I plug my TV in so that it shuts off when something else shuts off, will that damage the TV?
I would not use one of those with a television set.
Okay.
When you lose power to it and it comes back up, I mean, there's a reason why it stays in kind of this low power state. It takes a while to come back up anyway. I imagine it would take even longer to come back up. So I and plus, you know, you get a little surge to it.
Is it just a power strip that you bought, or is it a power strip that came with a TV?
No, it's a generic one.
Okay,
well,
yeah.
Not a generic one, but it's
my recommendation.
Did not come with a TV.
Yeah, my recommendation would be not to use a power strip to power it up and power down all of your hardware, like your TV and your VCR and your cable box and all that. What I tend to do is I plug into a power strip, and then I use the on-off switch for every device that's on it. You know, computers need to be shut down properly. The TV, I know that when I turn my TV on, it kind of does a slow power down and a slow power up. And it's not a plasma, but I've got a new flat panel HDTV. And you turn it on, the little red light comes on, the TV warms up, and then we turn it off, the light kind of slowly fades off. I don't know that I'd want to just kill power to it, you know, at the circuit. I'd rather let the TV power itself off.
I actually have a uninterruptible power supply on my HDTV just to protect it from power surges. So it always has that battery power there to it. So that's actually what I recommend for folks, is that they put a UPS on their television.
That's a thought. Okay.
All right.
That would be it.
All right. Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Yeah. Bye. They're so inexpensive now, and you don't really need a really high-powered one on a TV. The main thing you want to do is protect it from surges, and a UPS does that pretty well. Yeah. All right.
I think it's switched over, and I don't know. There's like more thing, and then just finish the news if you want, or should we just give it up?
You want to hear the last story? You're on the end finally when everything kind of went to hell.
It was getting very close. Yeah. Basically, just to finish up where I was talking about, the Apple's dropping the YouTube app from iOS, and the big three things that Apple sees changing is it's a big opportunity for stuff like Spotify, RDO, Rhapsody, Moog, those types. Another thing it's a big opportunity for is HTML5 video. So that, apparently Google's new mobile web already makes the iPhone YouTube app obsolete, so it may be that you don't even end up needing an app for it. And finally, it could be a big opportunity for Vimeo as far as places for, this is related to music and music videos and concert type video. So finally, on new products, this one actually was out last week, and it's one of those where, and I'm sort of surprised by the source, but you know how the devices that come from Apple that look that have sort of a perfect look for what they are? It's one of those where the design and the look of it just really fits together with the personality of how you're going to use the device. And some of the new Windows 8 accessories, you know, Apple has announced Microsoft has announced some new hardware that's going to come out for the new Windows 8 release. And the one that is really cool looking is called the Wedge Mobile Keyboard. And you can look it up to see pictures, but since obviously I'm not going to be able to describe it perfectly on here, but it really cuts down to the bare minimum. There's no real bezel around it. It's a keyboard. And the keys all fit within the space of the device. It's a Bluetooth keyboard with an aluminum back and black keys. And there's no, but the layout of the keys, there's nothing funky on it. It just looks very clean, and it's a black motif where Apple has lately a kind of aluminum and white motif for their stuff. It just is a really striking looking keyboard, and it comes with a cover. It's made to be portable. The idea on this one is that it's for you to take around with you to use with like tablets and such. And so the cover on it is made of a soft rubber so that you can put it in your bag and have that soft cover against the front of your tablet, and it won't scratch it up. And then it also kind of does double duty to help you carry it, you know, carry the keyboard, and you can fold it up and use it as a stand to hold your tablet. So it's kind of usually Microsoft can like think of one or two cool aspects to these things, and I'm not dissing their ergonomic keyboards or any of those kinds of things. That they usually can think of at least one or two cool things with their products, but this one really seems like this looks like they kidnapped an Apple designer to do the keyboard, and that they really thought about how to make this useful. There's a mouse that goes with it that's a little odder. It's shaped. The Wedge name, I think, comes from this mouse because it's very blocky and looks sort of wedge shaped. It uses Bluetooth and Microsoft's BlueTrack technology, but what hides beneath the buttons is a touch sensitive surface, which you can pull up and down through the Metro UI. Apparently, the other kind of clever feature on the mouse is on the battery compartment. Once you open it, you can't latch it again unless the battery is in the right direction, so you don't have to worry about putting the batteries in and then not having it work. So the keyboard is really the one that looks more interesting to me, because it looks like the kind of thing that you would carry around with a tablet, where I will say Apple on that particular kind of accessory has not really hit it. Other companies have had cases with keyboards involved that are more effective as an add-on for an iPad. So I really am interested in seeing when people start getting their hands on and using the Wedge portable keyboard to see what they think of it. And that's the news.
All right. It's still a little cutting in and out, but it definitely was better than previously.
It might be my computer, too.
When are you going to get a new computer?
Switch to Ethernet. Do a drop and reconnect, because otherwise I was going to have it interrupt me in the middle of a rant about Flick doing this all on purpose. But
are you wireless at home, Pete?
No, I'm Ethernet.
Okay.
My desktop is Ethernet to the router.
I've been thinking about buying a new computer.
Maybe we should just do a wire directly from Flick to Pete.
Few hundred mile long Ethernet.
We'll just string some along his car the next time he comes down.
We'll need a couple of repeaters.
A couple. Big Tim can.
Well, that we don't run into lag just from the distance, even if we had repeaters.
We can switch to fiber.
Fiber. We'd have to go to fiber. Okay.
Why don't we just get transportation, some kind of teleportation thing with beam Pete into the studio for 15 minutes and then beam him back to San Antonio.
That's what fiber does.
There's that, this ain't an ad for it, but there's that Megabus thing. I know someone who's...
You've been seeing that those things have been wrecking and catching on fire?
That's not good.
Yeah, but there's a Houston Press article on the super buses, and apparently a couple of them have been involved in some pretty horrible accidents.
It's terrible.
One person's already been killed on a megabus.
Yeah.
12
well,
injured.
For the price, I guess.
For the price, it's worth getting flamed.
If they ran late enough, it would be cheaper than gas to go back and forth, and it would certainly be a lot easier. But the problem is the last one out of Houston leaves at 8 o'clock.
How much money in gas do you have to spend to get from San Antonio to Houston and back?
It's about 200 miles, and my car gets about 25 miles to the gallon, so the gas each way, so that, you know, because it's over 400 miles, that's 16 gallons of gas times, say, $3, that's about $50.
Alright. Well, maybe
Where the Megabus thing, if you book in advance,
I know it's a like couple of bucks.
Yeah, it's only a few bucks, so it's like $6 versus 50. I could do that just about every week, pretty easily if they had one late enough.
But, right, be even better if it delivered you right to the station
and had pizza.
It doesn't drop off that far from there. It's at somewhere like West Gray and Prairie or something.
And shish kebabs. So.
Waffles.
Yeah, there's any kind of number of food trucks somewhere near where you get
off. All right. Well, Phone lines are open, 713-526-5738 if you want to be on the air. On Technology Bites, we're entertaining your calls, so we invite you to dial in. We've got a couple of calls in the queue.
We're also entertaining ourselves.
Oh, yeah, we are. Groovehouse is typing hateful messages.
Oh,
not hateful.
That's
hateful.
Not true.
You're having sport. Having sport. All right, so Groovehouse.
Yes. Can't put a price on sport.
Good thing.
Just drop it. You know, next week we're going to be in fundraiser, so enjoy this while you can.
Soak it up.
Yeah, but we can't talk about that.
Because there's prices. Right? Yeah. 713-526-5738. Groovehouse?
Yes.
Deliver me from evil.
I shall. We're going to take a call that just came in, and I think it's pretty topical. So up next, we're going to take Michelle.
Michelle, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Oh, hey. I'm sorry to take you off computers, but this refers back to the last caller.
Yeah?
It kind of struck me. I've been turning everything off at the power strip for about a year. My flat screen and all the components that are attached to it. So far, nothing bad has happened. So my question is, what am I doing to all of my components and my TV, and what is a UPS device or whatever you mentioned?
UPS, uninterruptible power supply. It's basically a battery backup. It if your power goes out, it keeps powering things. It's usually used for computers.
Oh, like a Belkin.
Belkin is one of the manufacturers.
Yeah.
It also, what's nice about it is it essentially acts as a kind of a filter for power, and if you have a power surge, it provides better protection than just a power strip.
So what am I doing just turning it off?
What all do you have
at the power strip?
What all do you have connected to it?
VCR, VHS, flat screen TV. Yeah, I think that's it.
Well, you know, I don't, like we were talking about earlier, at least with my TV, and it seems to me that when I use the on-off button on the remote, that it kind of, the TV kind of powers down a little more slowly. I've never tried just, you know, yanking the power on it from the power strip, but the TV, you know, you issue a shutdown command. These newer TVs are a lot like computers, so... When you shut it off using the proper, you know, the shut off button, it actually issues a command to the TV to power down.
I suspect it probably even has a little battery in it to keep the date and time, because it has a date, time, and a calendar in it.
Right.
So one of the things that will happen is, you know, if you keep the power to it, and when it powers down, it has that little tiny bit of power that continues to get from AC. That it doesn't have to go to the battery to, just like with a computer, to keep the date and time.
You're saying it's keeping power. So yeah, so it's still even though you've turned the TV off, it's receiving some power signal.
A lot of modern components have leech power when they're off. They're basically always in a standby mode, and then they never hard shut off.
On the flip side of that, a lot of people will attach their things to a, you know, to a power strip just where they can save some money on power, where they don't have that standing power, you know, always trickling out.
But the downside is you know, when you turn on power to a device and you cold push it, I mean, it's essentially
kind
a shock. It's jarring to the device.
It takes it longer to start up.
Yeah, right. Powering it down isn't that big of a deal. It's the nasty wake-up call, I think, that comes when you hit that power switch back on. Does your VCR clock not blink midnight all the time if you're shutting it down? You said you had a VHS?
No, if I don't turn off all the power with the power strip, there's a... like a line of lights that stays on.
When you turn it on, the VCR still has the proper time, even though you've turned it off at the power strip.
You know, everything seems okay. I mean, I've been doing it for a year, and I haven't noticed.
It has a battery in the VCR too, and eventually the VCR will start flashing or what.
Some VCRs
won't
may not
have
clocks on their face anymore too.
So I should stop doing that then.
Yes, I would not do that.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what you get the universal remote for. Now, you can get a universal remote that will, with one button, will power everything down, but you'll still have those glowing lights that tell you that everything's in standby or whatever unless you pull power.
Right.
That's your call. I mean, in my mind, I have not heard anybody say, well, because I powered all my stuff down at the power strip, I fried my TV. But I've not heard that, but it makes sense to me, and now that it's come up in conversation, that it could be putting some wear and tear on the electronics, like especially like Barrett mentioned, less so maybe when you're turning it off, more so when you kick that power back on, because all the, you know, there's not that.
It's like a surge. It's kind of a surge that comes back through again if it's not really well metered.
Right.
So yes, I think you'll have to take this one to a higher power.
Hold on, Pete.
And see if the
Go ahead, Pete.
Go ahead. I think we'll have to take you have to take this one to a higher power and see if the Mythbusters will do it.
Mm. You know how many times you had to power it off and on again to get any kind of, you know, control data. You have to get two flat screen TVs. And turn them, yeah.
So you've got a smart meter. But yeah, I think what it comes down to is, are you willing to shave, you know, a few cents off your monthly electric bill in the interest of, you know, possibly shorting out or shortening the lifespan of some high dollar, you know, electrical equipment?
Yeah, absolutely. Gear. I didn't know I was hurting it, but now I know.
Well, I like Jay's idea. I mean, you can get like universal remotes that you can program to turn every single thing off, you know, in your house with the press of the button. And those can, you know, be had for not very much at all.
And I will think about that. I thank you guys so much. I love your show.
Thank you very much. Thanks for calling in tonight.
Is the IRC down?
No, you just can't connect to it on your connection.
No, someone on Twitter is asking if
IRC working.
Is down.
I'm in there.
Okay.
Flicted's in there.
I'm in there. Yeah.
It's just your access point. So if they're connected through your access point.
this Twitter user? Yeah.
No, I'm in. There's 12 people in it.
Okay.
All right. 7-1 what?
I was going to say, I wouldn't recommend, if you're going to put a UPS on some of your stuff there in your home theater, don't put a powered subwoofer on the UPS.
Oh, yeah, right.
It doesn't go well.
Tell me about that. What do you mean? I don't know why.
It draws so much power that to the UPS it looks like it's a power surge, and so the UPS just basically flips on and off over and over and over.
Really?
Although that's on the outbound side.
I don't know. That's what happened to me when I plugged in my sub. It did not like that at all, and I had to plug my sub straight back into the wall.
Oh, interesting.
It drew too many amps, or I don't know what the deal was.
Interesting.
The UPS did not like it.
All right, 713-526-5738. If you want to be on the air with us tonight. 713-526-KPFT. Groovehouse is anxious to screen your call and put you in the queue. We got about 15 minutes before the top of the hour. We have to take a short station break, but we will have plenty of show after that. We've got time to get a call or two on the air right now, and we'd love to hear from you. Like I said, next week we will be doing fundraising, which is always exciting and fun.
Only one.
We'll have to raise $1,900. In 2 hours. It's almost $1,000 an hour. Flick, did just stop. You and Groovehouse both, just stop. All right, well. How are you feeling, by the way, Flick? Did you say you didn't get sick. You didn't get sick?
No, I didn't. It just went away.
Damn you. It was worse in Barrett than it was in me, and it was worse in me than it was in you.
What?
It trickled down. The more people it filtered through, the seems the less impact it had.
Oh.
Patient zero had it the worst, I think. And then patient one did not have
Yeah, mine never turned into anything.
Hate you. 713-526-5738. 713-526-KPFT. Is the telephone down? I mean, the IRC's working, but is the phone's down? Ooh, my sound is working. Hooray. All right, 713-526-5738 if you want to be on the air with Technology Bites. We are taking power surge protector strip questions, UPS
horror
questions.
Stories.
Yeah, if somebody out there wants to tell us a story of surge protection.
Gone bad.
Surge.
With
all these crazy storms and stuff, you know, we have a pretty good lightning storm out by my house.
I was about to say, I have a crazy electric story of electric strike on a house.
All right.
And the electricity went through the electrical wiring and like went into the kitchen, and the kitchen wall had wallpaper that had like metal strips in the wallpaper, like gold or aluminum, like little strips at a 45 degree angle, and the electric strike actually went through and like blew the toaster like out of the receptacle off the wall and then shot up through all those little foil things and scorched all the scorched all the wallpaper.
Wow.
So your wallpaper had metal foil in it like those security tags on the old CDs and records and tapes? Wow. That's not good. Got a call coming in.
Yay.
713-526-5738. I don't want pity calls, but at this point we may need some pity calls. Some odd noises on the phone. 713-526-KPFT. If you want to be on the air with Technology Bites, as I mentioned, fundraiser will be next week, so we will be begging for your money. So if you want to have a regular Technology Bite show and be a part of that, this is your last opportunity before we go into fundraising. 713-526-KPFT is the number to call. We have a call in the queue. Groove House?
Yes.
Who is it?
All right, up next on the show, we're going to take Ben.
Ben, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Hey, guys. How are you today?
Good. How are you?
I'm great. I called up 2 weeks ago, and you guys gave me some advice about Kindle and e-readers and stuff like that, and I've just been enjoying the heck out of them.
You bought all of them?
Yeah, all of them.
Which one's your favorite?
Well, I went with Kindle, actually. I didn't buy a device. I had an iPad already, and I have an iPhone, and I ended up just going with a Kindle, and I bought two books, and it has an awesome feature. Like, I really wanted to be able to highlight and, like, then aggregate the highlights, and see them all at once, like, what did I highlight in this entire book? But it has an awesome feature where you can see what other people have highlighted.
Right.
Yeah, that is kind of neat.
Do you, is this a Kindle, the e-ink Kindle, or the Kindle Fire?
He's using the app on an iPad.
Oh.
It's not a device. I did not buy a Kindle device. I only bought the Kindle app for the iPad.
Well, you don't buy it. That's free, but the books in it are...
Yeah. You're right.
So can you just pick anybody that you know the name of and see what they highlighted? Or it has to be friends? I mean, do you have to have some kind of friend connection with them?
It doesn't tell you who highlighted what. It just says, like, 41 other people highlighted this passage.
Right. So I was going to say, like, oh, you've, like,
but you can
let's see
follow,
what so-and-so, like,
you can follow somebody. I have people who are following me on Amazon.
So I
can share what books I've bought if I choose to. But I don't highlight or do anything like that on the Kindle. But I do share the books that I read.
I would cool. buy Moby Dick just so I could highlight the word Eskimo. That's a Heather's reference.
Remember that movie Heather? It's later, man. She blew his little finger right off.
That's true.
Spoiler alert!
So I hope you don't mind. I was actually talking about something else.
All right. No, don't mind.
Yeah, thanks for the call. I was wondering about Arduino. I live in Houston, and I've been just kind of like wanting to buy it, wanting to get into it. It seems like a totally geeky thing to get into, and been out on all the websites and stuff, and I was wondering if there was a group in Houston where you could, have projects and stuff, references and on the web, and but then local stuff, too. I think people getting together to do this kind of stuff, like in a users group, would be awesome. If there's one out there, man, please let me know.
There is.
Called the Geek Gathering.
Yeah, there's no such group as of that. There's TXRX Labs, which is a Houston hackerspace. They do some Arduino classes from time to time, and also a lot of the open nights, people will just kind of hang out, play with Arduinos. But like Groovehouse said, the Geek Gatherings, we usually have, a handful of Arduinos out there where people kind of tinker with stuff and play with stuff. But, some of us are into Arduino, and there's no, like, Arduino users group or, like, Tinker Night or anything like that. It's kind of, catch as catch can.
Well, I mean, we should start one,
bring up all your gear the next Geek Gathering. I mean, really, we have a lot of people haul out, everything. We've had soldering irons, hot air rework stations out there just to make projects. People have built games and brought them out.
Cool.
Yes, there's a lot of code sharing and stuff like that. But, I would also check out, Adafruit has some sites out there. I know that there are a couple of sites that are trying to kind of get, collections of code together so people can kind of, put the stuff that they write back out there to play with. There's a lot of neat stuff out there. I'd say the one thing to check out is check out a program called Fritzing, like Fritz. ING, and it lets you mock up breadboards and Arduino's electrical components very easily, you know, graphically, to where you can then not only share your code, but you can share how you hooked up all your components and everything like that, the breadboard for whatever kind of projects you may put together.
Cool. That's the important thing to me, because I have a software development background, but I don't have a electrical engineering or anything like that, you know, and so,
And speaking of books, too, there are a few books out there on the Kindle, I think. There's Making Things Talk is pretty good. And there's also Arduino Cookbook by O'Reilly and Associates, which is a decent book. And I even want to say that Make Magazine has published a book or two that just kind of gets you up and going. But everything is like ANSI 92C. And it's super easy. You're working with about as much memory and process as you had like in the early 90s right now. So, I mean, it'll take you back, especially if you've been slinging some C code for a while. But, yeah, go get out there and just see what other people are doing and bring all your stuff out to the next Geek Gathering.
That sounds great. I will certainly do that. I was in the RC for a while, you know, radio-controlled helicopters and stuff like that. And there's a lot of soldering and stuff going on in there, and so I got into Arduino.
Well, cool. Google ArduCopter and Google ArduPilot. It's two UAV platforms that are based on the Arduino, so it ties right into that. You can fit some fixed wing aircraft or helicopters or quadrotors with Arduinos and just let them fly on their own until the military comes in and says, "Hey, we can't do that anymore." But right now, it's kind of wide open, so it's fun.
That's awesome. Yeah, it's both creepy and going to be a boom industry, I think, is the drones and all that stuff. So, but either way, hey, thanks a lot, guys. I love the show, and just keep it up.
All right. Appreciate it. Thanks for your call.
You're welcome.
Okay. It was last year at DEF CON that the guy demonstrated the radio-controlled drone that he could create from, inexpensive parts bought online.
Yeah, there were a couple of those. There's some quadrotor things going on, and then one guy actually. The big thing, I guess, with drones now, especially the fixed wings, they are like aerial attack platforms, more or less. So, just like Google was getting in trouble with their cars driving around, getting all the SSIDs of the access points. People can fly planes now above overhead, and they can get all the SSIDs. And then, if they want to attack a particular Wi-Fi network, they can just circle overhead for quite a while until they get enough packets to break it.
And if they put cameras on those, they'd be terrorists.
Yes. But
and if they put small missiles on them, they'd be the U.S. government.
I don't know if those are small missiles.
Right.
All right. Well, we are coming up towards our top of the hour break, so we won't have time to take a call. But if you want to get in the queue and to be on the air with us in the second hour of Technology Bites, we invite you to call 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. As we mentioned before, we are going into fundraiser starting tomorrow, actually, but our first fundraising episode will be next Wednesday night, so you should take full advantage of this regularly scheduled Technology Bites broadcast this evening and be a part of that. 713-526-5738 or 713-526-KPFT to be on the air with us this evening. So we are winding down now towards the top of the hour break, and we'll be back right after these messages. You're listening to Technology Bites Radio. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Dwight.
And he's
Groovehouse.
We'll be right back after these brief messages.
It's time for elections here at KPFT. Are you considering a run? 9 listener-sponsored board seats and 3 staff-sponsored board seats are up for grabs. Candidate nomination packets are now available at kpft.org. Keep in mind that you can self-nominate. Also, to vote in the listener election, you have until September 1st, 2012, to qualify by either volunteering 3 hours at the station or contributing at least $25. For information on qualifying to vote in the staff election, please visit the KPFT website. And for regular announcements and other election-related information, make sure to visit us on Facebook and Twitter, as well as kpft.org. This is KPFT Houston.
We had no quarrel with anyone. We only want to stop riding the buses until we are treated as any other passenger.
Tune in on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. for the best of our past, present, and future from the vault. From the Vault is a weekly hour from the Pacifica Radio Archives, a national treasure of interviews, performances, and important moments. In this weekly documentary series, From the Vault presents archival audio to bring history to life.
It sounds like Harvey Milk is trying to send a message out to other gay or non-gay people who want to run for public office.
Get involved. Build your base. Build your support. You can't just get out there and say, hey, I'm a nice guy, and I'm going to vote right on all the issues.
From the Vault airs Wednesday at 6 p.m. You can hear a repeat overnight Saturday following the program after hours. This is 90.1 Pacifica Radio, KPFT Houston.
Hey, Barrett, what's happening?
I don't know.
Well, room around town.
We interrupt this skit to bring you...
Yeah. That means it's time for...
Baritone!
Yeah. Anyway. Take it away, Barrett.
All right, it's Barrett Time Techno Edition. Actually, it's not. looks like this may be the second to last full show before we head into a minefield of fundraising and political preemptions. Though we're not the only people being preempted, it seems, it saddens me to announce the Houston Linux Users Group monthly meetings that once took place on the second and fourth Saturdays of the month that HAL-PC have been discontinued, at least temporarily. If any listeners have the inside story on what's up with HLUG, please email the show and let us know. And as of right now, I just don't know with that. And though Dwight may not know it, he'll be speaking at the Houston Area Apple Users Group a week from this Saturday. Topic of the talk, the new iPad, when rumor becomes reality. Assume that the entire talk is going to be dedicated to Apple's upcoming 7-inch tablet. Yes, Dwight,
no? Kind of yes, no.
Really?
Kind of yes, no.
Are you a believer in that now?
Kind of yes, no. You'll see. What I'm going to talk about is how Apple rumors evolve and then ultimately become real. And we're going to look at what happened with the iPad 3 and then look at... I was going to focus on the iPhone 5, but I probably will throw in some iPad 7.
That's pretty cool, and show up for that. Group meets at the Bel Air Civic Center on 7008 South Rice Avenue in Bel Air, Texas. You'll know you're close when the street signs change color or when you find yourself being pulled over for driving 1 mile over the posted limit. The general meeting starts at 9 a.m. with Dwight's presentation at 11. For a full listing of events, sort of peruse Dwight's CV. Very impressive. They've got a lot of it up there. I don't know if you've looked at that. Head to www.haaug.org. And while some people may think that the Apple offering a 7-inch tablet may be a departure from reality, I think that a better departure from reality could be had this weekend at the Space City Con, a.k.a. the Houston Summer Geek Festival. Boasting a large number of authors, artists, entertainers, and industry guests, Space City Con promises to be family-friendly. That must mean that William Shatner isn't coming. Let's check. Yeah, it looks like he's out, and Uhura is in. That's right. Nichelle Nichols, a.k.a. Lieutenant Uhura of Star Trek, the original series, will be in Space City this weekend. On-site registration begins tomorrow night, and the con gets going in earnest on Friday. Surf to www.spacecitycon.com for details, directions, and a full listing of events. Now, I hate to keep beating a dead con, and that's a con as in convention. I'd like to carefully point out to death, but I've got one more set of basic info from our time at DEF CON 20. Nothing uber technical, but rather a list of 11 precautions that visiting members of the media should take before getting onto the hostile network. And now that everyone's gone home, that hostile network could be the airport, hotel Wi-Fi, even the hotspot at your local coffee shop. So here they are. And we haven't done these in the past, right? I didn't run through these and forget about them, correct?
No.
Okay. So, again, we kind of shortened them, but one of them is keep your hotel key card deep in your wallet, not in your pocket. It can be scanned by touch. And that's good advice whenever you're in possession of a magnetic key card in a densely populated area. If you've got a key card in your front pocket and someone brushes up against you, they could actually very easily read and decode the contents of your card. So kind of out there, more of a thing at DEF CON, not so much here. The second one is do not use ATM machines anywhere near the conference. This is due to the fact that it's fairly trivial to add card skimmers on top of magnetic card readers present in all ATMs. It's probably best for you to only use trusted ATMs at major bank branches while still scanning them visually for anything that looks out of place. Three, not affecting us so much, but keep your RFID credit cards and IDs at home or in a special wallet. They can be scanned from over 200 feet away. This is very true. RFID chips, like the ones embedded in your smart credit cards or in U.S. passports, can be scanned from Excuse me, let me start totally over. I'm on Emacs now. Okay, so anyway, the RFID chips, like the ones embedded in all U.S. passports, were designed to be read at very close distances, say between 2 and 10 centimeters in most cases. A little hardware hacking has produced RFID antennae that are able to snipe the contents of the chip over very long distances, like 200 feet. The fourth one on there was turn off file sharing, Bluetooth, and Wi-Fi on all devices before entering Las Vegas, or whenever you're not actively using them, especially when not at home. These just open up avenues for attackers to get in. Five is do not use the Wi-Fi network at the Vegas airport or DEFCON unless you're a security expert or consulted with the Wall of Sheep experts. This was important because the sheer number of fake or malicious access points at DEFCON. Still, there are a number of easy-to-use tools that exploit the way in which wireless computers try to connect to their preferred networks. It's best to disable any kind of auto-join you may have and always double-check the name of the wireless access point you want to connect to before actually connecting. Otherwise, you wind up on 1UP and you've got a shaky Peter. Just a few more. Six, make sure you have strong passwords on all your devices. Don't send passwords in the clear. Make sure they're encrypted. But we've talked about passwords again and again, but we really can't stress how important it is to use strong passwords, plural, as in a different password for each important resource you connect to online. You may even want to enable two-factor authentication. Google makes this easy by sending a text to your phone anytime you try to log in from an unknown location. So not only, here we go with Emacs again, so not only do we have you to have your password, they would also have to have your cell phone in order to get into anything Google-related. And lastly, don't leave a device out of sight, even for a moment. Now, whether it's your workmate with a sense of humor or a questionable character looking to steal your iPhone, it's never a good idea to walk off and leave an electronic device behind, even if only for the briefest of moments. Quadruple this when traveling abroad, even to the point of not showing off any tech in public places in some parts of the world. And finally, say don't accept gifts, USB thumb drives, for instance, unless you know the person very well. Sometimes a thumb drive is just a thumb drive, but oftentimes it is not. They can be laced with malware, or even worse, contain microcontrollers that can communicate with your computer unbeknownst to you. And accepting gifts from strangers immediately before flying will also put you in some precarious positions when trying to clear TSA at the airport. That's about it. I don't think our group had any incidents while in the field. Jay, you came back clean.
Well,
except for the bug, just biohacking.
Computer hardware was fine, but my body was biohacked.
Well, hopefully these tips will keep all of you safe in your digital travels. But for now, that's it for your digital boot camp, and that's that for Barrett time.
I will say that the benefit of having your own hotspot when you're traveling is awesome, especially when you're traveling in a known hostile environment. The LTE network from Verizon seems to be pretty secure, and using my iPad as a hotspot in the hotel room, I think, prevented me from getting exposed to too many nasties while I was at DEF CON. And look forward to using that for all of my domestic travel. And I've been using my Android phone as a hotspot when I travel abroad, getting a SIM card. So trying to stay off of public Wi-Fi.
How much data did you use while you were using that hotspot? Did you monitor it?
I did not monitor it. I had, I think I had a gig of data, and I did not exceed it.
Really? You had the 1 gig, the minimum 1 gig, huh?
Yeah, and the thing that'll kill you is if you try to do maps.
Right.
That'll kill you.
Right. You can pre-cache maps, yes, though, on most, especially if you're using Google Maps, at least.
It's not as much fun. I mean, you can pull out a paper map for that purpose.
Right.
But trying to use the iPad, navigate off of that was killing the data.
I did a blog post earlier this week about I'm thinking about switching when I get my next smartphone from AT&T to Verizon, just because my experience on vacation with my the LTE iPad was so good compared to my AT&T iPhone that and so I kind of essentially in this blog post did the math of what it would take to begin moving my family off of this family plan on AT&T over to these new shared data buckets.
Yeah.
And it's very complicated and not clear. Even after kind of laying this all out, I still am not sure what I'm going to end up doing. But I'm really interested in the amount of data you use, because if we're all sharing this data and we start getting LTE phones, what happens?
Yeah.
You know, that kind of really concerns me. So I'm very interested in any anecdotes about people using LTE and what that does.
Well, I didn't use LTE when I traveled overseas. It was 3G.
Right.
So,
right.
But, you know, and I was pressing it, I think, more strenuously because of the uploading of images and so forth.
Right. Well, and you know, LTE, just because you have LTE doesn't mean you use support. Your data faster. It does if you're connecting to video and the video source says, oh, they have a fast connection, I'm going to give them high def.
Right.
And that's when you get into trouble. And I am increasingly use my portable devices for video. I do that more and more. So I'm very concerned about
it. Out of the range of Wi-Fi? Do you watch video on the road?
On the gym, on the treadmill, particularly. It's what keeps me going on the treadmill for an hour.
And there's no Wi-Fi at the gym?
The Wi-Fi at the gym is terrible. So I'm stuck using 3G or LTE if I've got a review phone at the time.
713-526-5738 if you want to be on the air with us tonight. We do have a call in the queue, but we have all of our lines are open and plenty of time left in the show. 713-526-KPFT to be on the air with us. Groove House?
Yes.
I know we have all the other lines are open. We have one call in the queue.
Yes.
So
we're staying on topic. Stay on topic.
Stay on topic, of course.
Stay on topic.
Is this person going to...
Enlighten us? Yes.
Oh.
We're about to be enlightened.
All right. 713-526-5738. While we take this call, you could be getting in line to be the next person on the air with Technology Bites. Groove House, who do we have?
We have Joel.
Joel, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Hello. I was just going to make some comments about power protectors, since that seems to be the topic for tonight. My experience is that there's three types. The most basic type is surge protection. And, of course, what that's trying to do is prevent a lightning strike, you know, the high voltage from that, from frying whatever it is that's downstream of your plug or rather your wall outlet. And I would say put surge protection on almost any electronic device in your home, except maybe a toaster, which is, you know, they're so inexpensive.
They cost less than the
anything that costs over $100, and, you know, microwaves, TV, all that stuff, you know, it needs some sort of surge protection. Now, some of that may be built into, you know, a little power strip, but really what you're getting for a power strip is the convenience of, you know, multiple outlets. So in general, you know, when I read power strips, I don't see that they're really designed for surge protection. And, you know, they rate them.
All right, I don't want to cut you, you know, off at the knees on this, but we got power. We've discussed surge protectors, and it's more of a question and answer kind of show rather than a...
Although maybe you can answer this question for us. You know, we have been working from a presumption that it's not a good idea to turn off a television set at the power strip. You're an electrical engineer?
Yes, sir.
Well,
of course, they don't teach anything that basic at school. That's trial and error. But this, as you know, has been an ongoing topic to discussion, at least as long as I've seen computers the last 30 years, that generally, you know, people who are in the IT hierarchy at various institutions, or at least this was more so maybe 20 years ago, they like to keep, you know, the computers plugged in on a standby or hibernate mode, you know, 24/7, for the reasons you mentioned, that, you know, there could be, you know, the cycling on and off, there could be problems. I've never personally bought that, and, you know, I've always turned all my electronic...
hibernate
mode in the sense that it's taking a little time.
Joe, the question isn't whether or not you should turn off your devices and turn them back on, and whether or not that, you're right, that's an age-old question. Whether or not you should leave your PC, just go into standby mode, or turn it off. The question that's come up a couple of times earlier in the show, if you were listening, was more about whether or not you should just deprive power to the device unceremoniously by unplugging it from the wall, as opposed to using the on-off switch on the device.
I would not recommend doing that, because anyone who's done that in the past, you know, like a refrigerator, Well, I wouldn't do it while a microwave's oven, but it is a high current device, you know, power tool, anything that's using a lot of current. If you plug that, you'll see a pop, you know, you'll see an arc of power. And, you know, that sort of surge obviously is not good for the device. Now, how many times you'd have to do that before you'd notice, you know, the device being damaged?
Right.
I'm not sure, but I would agree with you that just, you know, what you call unceremoniously disconnected. No, that's not a good idea.
What about the switch?
You know, whether there should be, you know, you'd ceremoniously turn it down, you know, turn it off, and then unplug it.
What about on the switch on a generic power strip? In other words, turning everything off and then back on with that.
That's the same thing I would think as depriving it of power.
Well, there may be.
Well, there is circuitry in
built into the. They call them MOVs. There may be some in there. But as a rule, I would not recommend. I mean, if I had an office computer and said, well, I'm tired of browsing the internet today, and you used to see people who are not experienced do that, just reach behind the computer and flip off that power.
Yeah, I would never do that. Right. That I would not do, because that has the operating system component as well. You need to shut the PC down to let it close all of its open files and stuff before turning it off.
But even non-computer stuff, I mean, one of the things I was going to mention is that I believe one of your the people in the room were talking about it's not a good idea to put, you know, subwoofers. Well, more, you know, what your caller, since it's a computer show, one thing I found, and I've talked to other people about this, is laser printers. They're also a high current, you know, they draw a lot of current when they turn on.
Yeah, when they they'll draw
I would not recommend plugging a laser printer into a UPS. Now, surge protection, yes, but not a UPS because they draw too much current
Turn on. Yeah, I mean, unless you're just worried about a print job being interrupted in the middle of it. I mean, there's not as much reason to hook something like that up to a UPS.
Yeah.
Good point.
I did want to make one other point. You know, we talked about surge protection and the UPS, like you mentioned, is most of them, the cheap ones, you know, the ones that look like blocks, you're right, they're just a big battery in that block. So if the battery fails, you basically just have to put it in the recycling bin or throw it away if you can't find a recycling bin. There is another class of these devices. It's called power conditioners, and I guess what they're doing is they're clamping, right? I mean, ideally you'd want, like if it's 120, right, you'd like it between 115 and 125 in that range. And, you know, computers are real sensitive to that, right? I mean, maybe your refrigerator isn't, but computers are, right? So you can buy, sometimes the UPS, the high-end ones have the power conditioners in, but you can buy separate power conditioners. And I've used those, you know, actually in line with UPS before. You know, the cheap battery, you know, the block battery type.
Okay. Well, good information, and I appreciate you calling in with that tonight.
Okay.
All right, have a good night. Thank you very much. All right.
Yeah, I actually have a power conditioner in at my home stereo. I've got a power conditioner. It's not a UPS. It's a power conditioner. I've got it. It's on all my electronic devices.
Well, I know that
stereo.
I know, like, in my house, you know, if my wife is activates, you know, runs a sewing machine in the sewing room, when she first hits it, the lights dim. You know, it pulls a drain on the
top. How old a sewing machine is this?
Pretty new sewing machine.
Huh.
But it's just, it will just, you know, draws that power. I mean, it has to do with the old wiring in our house. Our circuit breaker probably needs to be replaced.
Right.
But we used to have a real problem with lights dimming when certain appliances came on until we had somebody come in and tighten all of that up.
I gave a party one time in the 80s. Remember when you could rent margarita machines and you'd bring a margarita machine in? We lived in this condo in San Antonio, and I remember it was going to have this great party. You're going to have margarita machines and all kinds of drinks. I bring the margarita machine in, set it up, we fire it up, and it kills the power in the house. Like, kills it dead. We lost the almost everything in the box blew. And no party. That was the end of it.
Well, you know, the point I was going to make was that, you know, when you have power that kind of ebbs and flows like this, not a constant stream of current, the current goes up, the current goes down, that kind of unclean power can cause an unnecessary strain on your devices. And that's what we were talking about, the the power conditioner. What that does is it takes the incoming power and then it regulates it to a steady stream to your device. So that, you know, I've heard of computers and other hardware going bad in houses that have older wiring or unclean power, what they call unclean power, or what I've heard
referred to. Dirty power.
Dirty power.
Yeah.
Even.
Yeah, my power conditioner actually shows the voltage that it's feeding through, and so I can see it fluctuate between, I don't know if I've seen it below 116, and I've seen it, I think, as high, usually it's at 119, but it'll be 120, sometimes it'll be as low as maybe 116 or 17, sometimes 120.
It's all ball bearings.
Sometimes the gerbil does not run as fast as you'd like for him to. And sometimes he runs faster. All right. 713-526-5738. Got a call in the queue. And who is it, Groovehouse?
Up next, we're going to talk to Joe.
Joe, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Hey, guys. How are y'all doing tonight?
We're doing all right. What can we do for you?
Well, I have an interesting scenario. I've got 7 local offices all connected via MPLS networking. And we already have our main stuff is all done in the cloud, so it's backed up there. But I have a lot of like Word documents and actual video files from cameras that we want to save at a centralized location. So I'm trying to figure out the best way to do that.
So you're trying to have your files on a machine, on a physical machine at a central location for all of these other computers to access?
Well, no, just for backup.
Oh, you're trying to back up all of these computers to one location. I'm not sure how that would work. You're saying MPLS, that's a VPN network, so you basically have all of these kind of connected over the internet to each other using a VPN situation, right?
Right, and we're sharing voice and data over that. We have our phones and networks all connected through it.
Well, I know for where I work, all of our backups are, you know, they're connected directly to the servers. And a network switch at the location where all the servers are. Are you wanting to back up computers at all the 7 locations to a single location?
Correct.
What kind of data connections do each of the offices have? I know you said MPLS is going to be the VPN that kind of holds them together, but how are each of the offices connected? Yeah, is it fiber or cable or?
Yeah, what kind of throughput are you? What kind of bandwidth do you have at each of the locations?
I'll be honest with you, I don't know. I would imagine it's got to be one that. God, it could be 1 to 10 megs for all I know.
That makes a pretty big difference. I mean, 10 megs is doable if you schedule it at night and if you're doing incremental backups. 1 meg is, that's old DSL speed, so it could take a while to do. I would run speed tests and see, or even you maybe like stage like a large file on one of your main file servers there at the main office, in the location where you'd be wanting to back up, and just, either download the file or upload something and see how long it takes. That way you can see if it's even worth the time to start looking for solutions. Because if it's going to take, a day to back up one computer, then that might not be your best way to go.
We're not looking to back up the whole computer. It's more like Word documents. When they create or edit a document that they're going to send to somebody, when they save it, we'll point it to a special directory, and that directory is what will be backed up.
Okay.
So you're talking maybe, I would say on average, probably about 100 megs a day if you include the video files, because it's not constant video or
okay,
even
so
motion.
Okay, so not an incredible, they're not backing up, roomfuls of servers and desktops
right.
and so forth.
Are these Windows 7 machines or XP or what?
It's a mix. We've got Windows 7 and XP Pro SP3s. And no, we have no physical servers at this point. So we're looking at doing like a network attached storage at each location and then probably a RAID 5 at the central.
Well, if you don't have any servers and you're not looking to install any kind of like server software, you may just want to look at appliances. I know that Netgear has some stuff out there. There's some things called ReadyNAS. There are a lot of, just kind of drop-in network-attached storage solutions out there that you can just drop in either at the central office or, like you said, each of the different branches, and you could just be good to go out of the box.
Yeah, one solution we were looking at was doing a NAS at each location and then just having the central location back up each of those storage devices nightly.
That would be a lot faster. I mean, your users wouldn't notice any kind of a slowdown at all during the day. That if you guys can afford, you know, an extra NAS like that, that would be the way to do it.
Cool. I'm in the right direction then. That's what I like.
Yeah, read the reviews, and especially if you're going to have, like, multiple, you know, NAS devices out there, seeing if any of them ship with, like, a single control panel to where you don't have to administer them each individually, to where you can, you know, like, push out updates or say, you know, do the organization, do the different rules and permissions on all of them, all from a single control panel. That'll save a lot of time, too.
Oh, tons.
Yeah, so just see what's out there. But I'd say check out Western Digital, check out Netgear, check out, you know, a few things like that, and you should hopefully find something that fits in the right price range and, you know, will do what you need it to do.
Awesome. You guys are great, man. Keep up the work, and I'll actually call in during the pledge drive. I pledge to pledge.
All right. Awesome. Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks, guys. Y'all have a great night.
All right, thanks. You too. Thanks for your call. All right, 713-526-5738 if you're in the Houston area listening tonight on a Wednesday night. We invite you to call in to Technology Bites, 713-526-KPFT. We have about a half hour left in the show. We've got open lines, only two calls in the queue. So if you wanted to be on the air with us this evening, this would be a good opportunity for you to call, 713-526-5738. Groovehouse.
Yes.
What up?
What up, Jay?
What up? Who do we have up next?
Up next on the show.
Who up?
Up next on the show.
You mean next up?
Who that?
We're going to talk to D.
I still make Greenhouse laugh. That's like an old
yo.
Hey, what's up?
Hey, man, this, that, and the other thing besides the damn heat.
Yeah. Tell me about it.
Well,
don't it was tell me
so
about
hot.
The heat. How hot was it?
Oh, man. I'm having some virus problems, I still think. I actually put the box in to have it scrubbed, but I've got this Kaspersky internet security and antivirus.
Uh-huh.
And I ran the dadgum thing, and I'm still kind of, you know, getting used to it. It's supposed to be the best operating system. I'm on the market right now, but I ran this vulnerable application. And it comes up with a QuickTime, QuickTime player, Java, Image Burn, Winamp, and a Flash player. So, you know, when I go to the details part of it, it gives me a website and gives an explanation that says that it might cause a memory problem. And that's essentially what I'm having. The Dell 690. And I got a little book on the error code, and it either gives me a system memory board failure or memory failure. 1-2 or 1-3 is a light code. And, you know, I took it to this place and they fixed it once, but just got the box back today. I haven't hooked it back up, but a friend of mine was telling me, well, you need to figure out, you know, if they've actually scrubbed all the viruses off or not, and try to figure out if you've heard anything about a memory problem, you know, because he wants you to update, especially Flashpoint, specifically a Flash player. He wants me to update to the latest version.
Well, if you run any of these programs like Flash or QuickTime or Java, you want to make sure you're running the latest versions of those softwares.
Right.
So what I would recommend that you do for sure is you go to java.com and download the latest Java. Make sure you have that going. Google search, download Flash, Adobe Flash Player. That'll take you to the link to get the latest Adobe Flash Player. Update that. You know, if this software is coming back and telling you that your stuff is out of date and it's vulnerable, it's probably accurate.
Now, the problem with Flash player, specifically Adobe Flash player, I tried to download the latest version. I forget, a 9.5 something. I tried to get it. Will not let me do it.
Well, sometimes you have to uninstall the existing version of Flash and then try installing it.
Man, I thought I did that. You know, I went to control panel, uninstalled programs, had to remove programs.
Did it go away?
Yeah, I even deleted the, you know, because I wrote down the where it's held on my C drive. I got the C drive I use for programs, and then a RAID 5 that I save my data on. And I went to, it was C program files, x86, And I forget the other one.
Well, you don't have to go manually yanking stuff out necessarily, but Flash can sometimes have trouble getting installed. I've seen people have trouble installing Flash in the past, and that can be somewhat dicey to try to troubleshoot, because when you install Flash, it takes you to this web page that kind of does this automated install.
Yeah.
But there's a way to get around that where you actually get the executable, the downloadable executable file that it will install Flash, and sometimes that'll get you around it. Barrett, did you want to...
Yeah, no, that's what I was going to say is don't mess around with the Flash installer. Just Google, go get the right one, either 32-bit or 64-bit for your system, and then install it manually like that.
But it can be tough to find sometimes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because it's a 64-bit system, and the thing was telling me was not compatible. Well,
you might have downloaded the 64-bit installer or the 32-bit installer?
The 64-bit.
The 64-bit installer is designed for 64-bit browsers. It'll run in like 64-bit Internet Explorer, but almost all of the browsers that run right now on Windows are actually the 32-bit ones because of the issue of Flash. So
that's true. Because Internet Explorer, the standard version of Internet Explorer
is 32-bit.
Right. And there, for the longest time, there was no 64-bit Flash. It didn't exist until pseudo recently, because Internet Explorer 64-bit had no Flash support. I know this because I never ran 64-bit version of Internet Explorer, but I had a number of my listeners and readers who have discovered the 64-bit version and ran that, and then they said, why can't I get Flash video? Just because it didn't exist. So what I would recommend that you try doing is getting the 32-bit version of Flash and running just the regular version of Internet Explorer and installing that.
I'm still running XP64. That's what I'm running. I haven't updated yet.
Okay. Hey, are you sure XP64? XP64 is a rare beast.
It's XP64 Professional,
It exists.
Yeah. I know it exists. It's just I don't run into that many people running it.
The other thing you can try to do is download Chrome, Google Chrome, which has Flash built into it. And that will enable you to see it without actually having the Flash installer present.
And then go back to your original question about making sure that you're scrubbed clean and free of viruses and stuff. We've talked about this on the show over and over again.
I did the Hitman Pro. I went to your site. And
are they finding anything?
It found several things.
After you've gone and had your computer professionally cleaned?
Well, I haven't run it again yet.
Mentioned that your friend said you should double check now that they've done it to see if they've really done it. So maybe that's what you should do is go grab Hitman Pro and maybe even Spybot Search and Destroy and those programs and just run some scans, because Kaspersky, whatever it's called, it's a good program, but it doesn't discover all of the... It's not a complete anti... You know, there's just so much out there that I always recommend running two or three different programs to test for it.
Right,
because none of them seem to detect at all.
But have you heard of these Flash and Winamp and Java creating memory problems?
Yes, they're all notoriously... They've got memory leaks, especially Flash. Like the first 3 months, 4 months of the year, that's all they could try and contend with were the memory leaks in Flash. So that's why they're always coming with new updates, and that's why a lot of things crash. It's just all programs kind of go through that. Firefox had a bad year, too, with just memory leaks all over the place. So that's going to happen more often than not, just because the way that people are developing these days.
Yeah, so my board's probably okay, because I've been pulling out my...
Well, what's actually telling you that there's a memory issue? Is that the Kaspersky's telling you that, or where are you seeing these messages?
Actually, two places. Really three. First, when I try to boot up, I will get the Flash code on the front panel of the box itself.
That's a hardware error, so that is telling me that there is a hardware issue. If you're getting if you're getting a Flash code or getting some kind of beep code.
Right.
That,
the thing of it is, if I push the button to stop, and let it sit 15, 20 minutes and try to power up again, it'll go completely through.
Okay. What that tells me is you've got an intermittent hardware issue. This is not related to software. This is pre-operating system, pre-boot,
yeah,
you're getting this message. It's hardware. It's not software. It's hardware. Now, the fact that it's intermittent obviously makes it a little bit more challenging to discover what it is. How old is this computer?
Oh, man. I've had it 2 years. I bought it used, and the guy said he put it together the year before that, so it's about 3 years old.
Right. Letting it sit and it going through, that kind of screams heat issues to me.
That's what I was going to say, is that it's got an overheating problem.
Man, I got two fans, and I call it my thermal solution. I've got one of these Blizzard fans I put on the front.
Yeah,
I gotta,
maybe not.
It runs on...
Was it doing this before you sent it to have them work on it?
Yeah.
Okay. The other thing is, you know, open it up, make sure all your memory's seated firmly. You know, double check that, and it may just be that you've got a bad memory card in there, but if it's beeping it, because what Barrett mentioned with it kind of doing it once and then not doing it when you restart it, because if it has a heating problem, the plastic on the circuit board or on the system board expands and contracts. And sometimes things will get loose, but then it'll cool down and they'll tighten back up. So it's a tough one to diagnose. But I will tell you this, so, you know, forget all the software stuff. This is a hardware issue.
You think so?
Oh, no, I know so.
Don't tell me that.
I know so. Because there's no software coming into play to make that hardware beep at you like that when it's first firing up, because the computer has to go through a number of system checks before it even reaches out to the hard drive and loads the operating system. And if it's doing it before you get the Windows logo or any of that stuff, that's a hardware issue, guaranteed.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I guarantee.
Dadgummit. So I'm looking at probably how would I try to isolate it?
That's the tough part. That's where it gets really tricky, isolating these kind of problems. How much memory is in the computer?
Right now it's only 25, really 26.
26 what?
Cool. Gigs.
Of RAM?
Of RAM.
26 gigs of RAM?
What kind of server is this?
Are you kidding? Huh?
That's not even a right number.
Huh?
I took 4 gigs sticks out.
4? 1 gig sticks out?
No, 1. I took 2 4 gig sticks out. It's a total of 32. A total of 32 will fit in this box.
32 memory sticks will fit in this thing.
The 32 gigs total.
32 gigs.
How many slots do you have?
There's 8.
8.
Right? Yeah.
And you've got how much memory in it, right? 24 gig?
26.
26 right now.
You should definitely not have any memory problems at all.
Here's
unless
one thing.
Unless one of those memory sticks is bad.
Right.
Yeah, you can get really weird issues. I would pull it down, pare it down to 4 gigs of memory.
Your That's
best
how you're
sticks.
Troubleshoot.
Try and find your newest, shiniest, most paired memory sticks. Even just put one. If you've got a 4 gig stick in there, just run with one, or get two that are matched. Run like that for just a little bit and see if your machine doesn't like stop shutting off.
And everything will still work fine because
4 gigs is a lot of memory. 8 gigs is a lot of memory.
A lot of memory. I mean, generally.
Yeah, but when I start rendering stuff, man.
All right. But, I tell you what. Dee, you asked how to troubleshoot this, and this is how you're going to troubleshoot it. You're going to take all your memory down to the lowest number you can get by on. You're going to run it for a while.
Okay.
And if it works fine, then you're going to add in 2 more sticks of RAM.
Put a check mark on that memory.
And put, you know, right on these memories so you know which one it is. If then it starts acting bad, you're going to take those 2 you just added in, you're going to take them out, put 2 more in.
Okay.
And you're going to go through until you find that bad memory stick, or you're going to go buy a memory tester.
There's also some memory tester software, which might or might not.
Yeah, there's some Linux. There's some bootable Linux CDs that come complete with, like, you know, RAM testers, as well as they'll actually mount up any kind of hard drives that are attached to the system and do their own antivirus scanning on them, to where if you want to know, you know, from a good, known, clean, bootable CD that your hard drives are fine, that would be the way to do it. And it'll also run the memory test on there, too.
Okay,
but yet, memory will play, it'll wreak havoc with machines, and with that many sticks in there, the chances are pretty good that you've got a bad stick of memory somewhere in the mix.
Yeah. So that's a bootable Linux system?
Yeah, like Google for like Linux CD Live, maybe, and then let's see, and then AV. So just do Linux CD Live AV, and you're going to get a few of them out there. There's going to be a full list of Linux-based antivirus rescue CDs, and that's what you're going to want.
Okay, cool.
I'm just curious, what computer is this? What kind of computer?
It's a Dell 690.
I don't know. I don't know Dell models very
let's
well.
Let's see.
Yeah, it's like it's getting old, you know, but man.
It's getting old and I got 64 gigs of RAM in it. And I
don't want to see who it was.
I don't know.
It's a Precision workstation?
Yes.
Okay. I don't think, man, kudos for getting 26 gigs of RAM in there, man. I'm super impressed, but I bet that's your issue at the same time.
Well, how much memory can it hold?
32.
That is a hell of a lot of RAM.
Yeah, yeah.
And Dell 690?
Well, basically a server box, you know. It's just the dual quad. You're only at 266, you know, but like I said, I use it to render stuff and for 3D animation. So.
Well, one of those sticks are rendering you inoperable right now, so you gotta render it before it can render you. So good luck with that, man.
Hey, appreciate the help, guys. Appreciate it.
All right, good luck, man. Thanks. Thanks for your call.
Thanks a lot.
All right. That's a hell of a lot of RAM.
That's a 690.
It's a Dell Precision 690 workstation. It's like one of the ones with the metal frames that were kind of cool. They're maybe, you know, 5-6 years old.
32 gigs.
They were never meant. I mean, they were, some of these shipped with some beefy configurations, but that's just a lot of RAM, especially if you're running on, he said he was on XP Pro.
But it could hold 32 gigs of memory?
Yeah.
I'm a little shocked by that. I don't even want to go look.
I mean, I know we have some servers that can handle insane amounts of memory. I mean, terabytes of memory. But
these are like mini power systems.
Even 64-bit XP address
They
that
can
much
address
memory?
32 or 64 gigs, actually.
They can address a lot.
The thing is that once he's got that many sticks, swapping them all out to find which one is the bad one is just going to be a horrible nightmare.
Yeah, so... And even if you run software tests, it may not tell you which chip.
Well, the software tests that I've used will tell you which slot it's in. But if you have that many slots,
it's going to take a long time to test. It can take, if you would run all the memory tests, even just on like 8 gigs, it can take a couple of hours. So right.
Just let it run overnight and let it see what it does.
All right. Well, 713-526-5738. If you want to be on the air with us, Groovehouse's reaction to me slamming down the drink can.
I've only got 8 gig of memory.
Don't you feel inadequate now?
Yeah.
Your rendering is weak.
Yeah, I don't ever render anything.
Yeah. Well, the only thing
I render is fat.
And render a deceased. I've been kind of gravitating more to watching, you know, since the Olympics have been on, I've been gravitating to watching G4 lately. And they had a 4-part series, the top 100 video games of all time. And I've gotten down to the last 40 and I haven't checked to see, I haven't watched that episode yet, but it's great watching this show because they're interviewing various celebrities and they're showing clips from the games and so much of it is like, you know, the old Atari stuff and things like that. But
Was E.T. on the list?
I haven't seen E.T. yet, but one that captured, just took me way back to a distant time in space was Gauntlet.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, Warrior need food. Warrior is about to die.
Oh, that's what that was from. Okay. I saw that come out. I didn't know where that came out of the blue. Huh?
You didn't know where that was from?
No, I knew what it was from. I didn't know why.
That's why.
I didn't know if you've been watching documentaries on G4. Okay. Yeah.
I say that every once in a while.
Warrior
needs food badly.
Yes, Elf is about to die.
I figured he was messing up a Skyrim quote or something. I wasn't sure.
No, that was a Gauntlet
That's
quote.
Cool.
No, the E.T. game is like pretty much considered the worst game ever made in the history of gaming. Partially because it was rushed. And so the game wasn't even complete. Like, it wasn't tested, it wasn't complete, but then, like, even just to start off the game it didn't make any sense, the documentation didn't make any sense, plus, they printed, like, a zillion of these cartridges, and, like, nobody wanted it. So it's that got a really horrible reputation.
I know we played a song a while ago, I think Jay might have even brought it in, called Code Monkeys or something like that. Code Monkey by John Coulter. Is that the guy? Have you guys seen the animated series that did 2 or 3 seasons on G4? This is new to me.
Oh, it was the 8-bit cartoon.
Yeah, the 8-bit cartoon. Steve, Wozniak actually plays parts on it. Like, he's the main boss in episode number 1 of a gaming company. It's called Gamavision, like ColecoVision. It's making fun of a lot of the late 80s, early 90s Activision. you know, those kind of things. But there are a lot of references of early games. Usually, like, someone comes in with a great idea, and they're like, no, that'll never work. No, you don't want to do, Steve Woz, you don't want to do computers, personal computers, no. Console and arcade games, that's where you want to be. But it's pretty neat. I had never seen it before. The neat thing is, almost a lot of it is modeled after 8-bit games, so calling out those early 8-bit games is kind of fun.
There's a new animated movie coming out, and I can't remember what the name of it is, but it's about video game characters, and the hero of the game is an 8-bit video character, but he finds his way into all these other... His adventures...
Is this a movie?
It's a movie. It's coming out soon. It's I don't know if it's... I don't think it's a Pixar. I
heard about it.
But the main character is an 8-bit video game character... kind of like Donkey Kong-ish, but he's traveling through all these other video games. His quest takes him into these other... There's like one scene where he's in some kind of like Halo-like game. He's like, when did video games become so violent?
Is it coming to the big screen or is it like your parents' basement?
Big screen, yes.
Halo. That sounds too cool and geeky to be true.
It's I thought Afflicted when I saw the trailer for it.
You sure you didn't dream this?
It's coming out this summer.
It's coming out soon, and I can't remember the name of it. Now I got to find it.
Did you fall asleep while watching G4?
Warrior need food.
It's like Contra, but Gauntlet. But
don't shoot food. let's see. God, now I need to know.
8-bit video game characters attack NYC, summer 2013. New video as we're loading
What's
up.
What's the name of the movie?
Like it's true.
What's the name of the movie?
Yeah, it's a Disney movie, and let me see. I just found a link. I'm loading up the link right now. Now I just want to.
The internet is slow here.
The internet is slow. Internet needs food. Internet is about to die. Wow, did I jump back on 1UP or something stupid?
I feel like I did. Like my stuff just came to a halt. Oh, I've got to put quarters in.
Oh,
okay.
There we go.
Okay.
Wreck-It Ralph. WRECK-IT Ralph.
See, that's not something with that name I would never have been interested in.
I didn't pay attention to the first time I saw it, but then I saw a good trailer for it.
Uh-huh.
And it looks like... Now I'm kind of like... I'm into video games now. Like, you know? And no, it looks good. I think it really touches on a lot of the history and genre of 8-bit.
And it's not about a small mouse on a motorcycle, just to make sure, right?
No.
Okay.
No. And,
is it Wreck-It or Wreck-Um?
It's Wreck-It.
Wreckitt.
Wreckitt.
Yeah.
Wreck-It.
Okay.
Wreck-Um Ralph, does that take you somewhere else horrible?
No, that's what they were saying on IRC.
Yeah, Wreck-It Ralph. They were trying to say on IRC we weren't paying enough attention to them, but
not to be confused with Rectum Ralph.
Hey, hey-o.
Talk about your one-liners.
That takes you somewhere else.
Well, check out the trailer for it. It looks interesting. I thought of you, Flicked, when I saw the trailer. It looked like it plays upon, you know, video game genre in a good way.
I've seen this poster all over Houston. Like, people, there's an 8-bit guy with red hair that looks like a Nintendo version of the Hawaiian Punch guy on a black background, and I've been seeing these posters all over.
I haven't seen it. Yes, I have seen that.
There's even in the Montrose, they're posted up on some of the stores.
It's ramping up kind of interesting. Man. Like I said, when I first saw the first thing about it, I kind of dismissed it because there's been some like family movies coming out that look really, really horrible. Like they're so horrible. Like I went ahead and watched the trailer and just confirmed that that's going to be horrible. But this was one of the ones I watched during that period. I'm like, that's going to be good. That actually was more interesting than I first gave it credit for.
It's like Toy Story, but with video games.
Yeah, sort of like that. It's Disney, but I don't know who the animators are behind it, but it looks really cool. All right, 713-526-5738. I've blathered on enough about that. Groovehouse?
Yes.
Still there?
I am.
How you doing?
I'm all right.
All right.
Yeah, doing good.
Who's up next?
Follow me on Instagram. Up next, we got Joe.
Joe, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Hey, how's it going, fellas?
Good, how are you?
I'm doing all right. Okay, I have this desktop PC. For some reason, a couple of weeks ago, it stopped working. It's not getting any power. I switched out. At first, I thought it was the, I don't know what you call it, the power...
The power supply?
Yeah, the power supply. I replaced the power supply, right? I thought it would be strange because I had replaced the power supply like 6 months ago. So the one I currently have is only 6 months old. So I didn't know why it would, you know, it would fail so early. So I got a new one. Both power supplies, they test fine. I plug it directly, it cuts on, but somehow it's not getting power to the motherboard. I don't know how to fix that. Is it done? Is it dead? Or what?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, when you plug the, when you got a brand new power supply.
Yes.
Of the proper kind, and you've hooked it up, and they're usually pretty hard to connect incorrectly. I mean, the cables are keyed a certain way, so yeah. You can only plug them in one way.
Yeah.
So when you put it all back together and you turn it on, the power supply, does the fan start spinning?
Yeah. No. There'll be like a little jolt. The fan will just shake for a second, but then nothing else happens.
That's all that happens on the power supply? Not the fans on the motherboard, the fan on the power supply.
The fan on the power supply is on.
Okay.
Okay, so it gives a little jolt to the system board, but nothing fires up. The whole system board doesn't actually come online.
One of the things about connecting a power supply to a motherboard is there's often more than one power connection. And if you forget the second one, it won't start. The other thing is that I've seen some power supplies that come with... They have the big, fat plug that you plug into the motherboard. And then the secondary plug can often be in multiple configurations. I had one power supply where you either put in... it had two plugs, and you either put the two plugs in together, or you put one of the plug in, but not the other one. You never put the other one in. And so there's like a, sometimes a combination depending on whether how the motherboard matches to the power supply. So be very pay a lot of attention to the secondary connection for that motherboard.
Like if you have the motherboard manual, check and make sure like where power should be plugged in for it to work.
Right.
Okay. Well, I also wanted to ask if is there any device that I can get, maybe a micro set of fries, that can test if the motherboard can get power?
The only way I would test if a motherboard could get power is if I hooked it up to power.
There are, I don't know if they're around anymore, there's a PCI card that used to run, you know, in the low three figures, that you could plug in to like a main board, and it would actually do diagnostics through the PCI bus.
Yeah.
Micro Center would definitely not have it. Fry's may have it. It's probably going to be something you'll have to find, like maybe at EPO, or I think that's where I saw it, or maybe even online. There are things out there, but again, you're talking, you know, $100 or so just to, you know, to test something where a new main board might not cost much more than that anyway.
Yeah.
That's true.
Make sure everything's seated. A lot of times, listen for any beeps. See if there are any lights on the main board that'll give you, like a lot of times there'll be like some lights on the back and it'll give you a code and you can say, oh, it's bad memory. Oh, it's this or oh, that and the main board's gone out. But just open the case, power it up, see if it's doing anything in there and then go to the manual and see if you can't figure out what exactly is happening before you start spending any money.
And make sure in particular that your video card is seated properly and also that if your video card may require power to it beyond that's another thing that will cause that. If your video if there's no video card it will halt. So do you have a connection from from the power supply to the video card?
No, it's not one of those kind of it's not a beast or anything that requires its own power supply. Okay. It's just plug and play.
All right.
All right. Well, sorry we can't help you more with that one.
Oh, it's okay. All right, thanks, guys. Great show, all right?
All right, thank
you. Good luck,
man. All right. 713-526-5738. Maybe we can get another call or two in, but we do have one in the queue, so we'll have to see how that goes. But it's roulette time if you want to try it. 713-526.
Should have asked our last caller how much RAM he had installed.
Well, anybody less than 32, not rolling 32 gig deep is... not playing right. All right, Greenhouse?
Yes.
Who do we have?
Up next, we're going to talk to Joanne.
Joanne, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
You're going to think I'm really a technological idiot, which I am, but I have a computer with XP, and it has Yahoo Mail on it, which is what I've always used. And I added a new MS, or Microsoft Word.
brand new one, and Outlook came with it. And now I'm getting mail in Outlook, but Outlook won't send mail out. It won't let me send any. And I get a message that my server has terminated the connection. And it has a server, SMTP, at yahoo.com, and it has the protocol.
Well, if you're going to have a server, it's going to be smtp.yahoo.com, I would imagine, not at. So it's possible that you have your outgoing mail server configured incorrectly.
Well, it's got smtp.
Okay.
att.yahoo.com.
Okay, so you have your email through AT&T, your Yahoo email through AT&T.
Yes.
Now, go ahead.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Can you have both Yahoo Mail and Outlook?
Well, you can have both. I mean, Yahoo is typically, by most people, accessed via a web page. Is that how you usually access your Yahoo Mail?
Yes.
By going to yahoo.com? Right. So you can have Outlook also check your mail. You can do both. But Outlook requires a specific configuration to be able to connect to Yahoo Mail. And I know that... if you're getting your Yahoo Mail through Southwestern Bell, or I mean through AT&T, they have instructions on how to configure the Outlook client for that connection. And there's some very specific settings you have to set besides just the mail server, because they require authentication, I believe, to send mail.
Probably over a secure port.
And it's also you have to be connected to your AT&T account to be able to use their mail server. It's harder if you're like using like internet at a cafe or something like that. Are you using this at home, or are you using this?
This one's at home.
Okay. I would either, since we're running out of time, I would either Google search configure Outlook AT&T Yahoo. Okay. And you'll probably find their instruction page that tells you step by step what you need to do to configure Outlook to use your mail. Or worst comes to worst, you can call up AT&T tech support, and one of their techs can probably walk you through it pretty readily.
Okay, thank you so much. So I guess I wasn't that stupid.
Wasn't that stupid, not at all.
All right, thank you.
All right, thank you. Thanks for your call.
Bye.
Right, bye. Oh, Warrior does need food. All right, well, we are pretty much out of time.
Wizard needs food also.
Wizard needs food. What was it? There was a wizard, an elf, a warrior, and there was a fourth character.
Was it a thief?
Fourth?
There was,
it was four.
It was a four-player game. It was the first.
It was what?
Wasn't it a female character?
There's a barbarian. Was a
Valkyrie.
Valkyrie.
Valkyrie. Valkyrie needs food. Valkyrie F, war, elf. Valkyrie, elf, warrior, and a wizard. And, you could pump a lot of quarters into that machine back then. That was the first multiplayer.
I never really played that game much, but I did see a lot of people pumping quarters to continue.
Yeah. I didn't play it all that much, but it was certainly, when the game was being played, it was a thing.
A lot of people gather around, I remember, in the arcades.
I mean, I never felt like the only way you could beat that game was pour more money into it. There was no actual strategy that would allow you to play on it. I'm on my original quarter! I don't think that happened. It was just designed for four people to stand around this thing and shove quarters into it. Oh, God, I gotta get back into it. They need my help. Don't shoot food. All right. Well, you've been listening to Technology Bites, and we're glad you tuned in. We'll be back next week. In Houston, we're going to do fundraisers, so that probably means if you're listening outside of the Houston area, you'll be listening to a best of or something, a previously broadcast episode next week. And then we'll be back the week after that. So we look forward to it. Stick around. More great programming coming your way at the top of the hour. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Dwight.
And he's
Groovehouse.
Follow him on Instagram.
This fall, KPFT will hold an election to seat members on the local station board. There will be separate but parallel elections for both listener and staff delegates. To qualify to run as a listener candidate, you must be a member of the station. A member has either donated at least $25 to KPFT or volunteered at least 3 hours since September 1st, 2011. To qualify as a staff candidate, you must complete 30 or more verifiable volunteer hours between June 1st, 2012 and September 1st, 2012. Nominations for the board began August 1st, 2012 and will close August 30th, 2012. For details on the elections, how to run and participate, visit KPFT's website at kpft.org. This announcement is brought to you by KPFT Houston.
Do you or someone you know own a local dining establishment? KPFT has a pledge drive coming up. And each drive, restaurants in the area feed our phone volunteers who give of their time to help KPFT reach its goals. Donations of food by these establishments are tax deductible and help community radio in the process. We also thank your establishment on air. Call 713-526-4000 for more information on how Houston eateries can lend a helping hand to KPFT. Ideal locations will be close to downtown Houston and be able to provide meals for 12 hungry volunteers. Again, that's 713-526-4000 for more information. This is 90.1 Pacifica Radio, KPFT.org, Twitter.com/KPFT, Facebook.com/KPFT Houston.